Izamit Carr, and I'm Telly Concepcion, and together we are Beyond the Numbers Podcast. We go beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. So come learn, grow, and have some fun with us. We are Beyond the Numbers Podcast.
On today's episode, the guys go beyond the numbers of the NBA bubble regular season. They follow up on the fluid status of college football, and on the 100th anniversary, provide a brief history of the Negro Leagues, its founding, its purpose, and its impact on Major League Baseball as we know it today. But first, their numbers of the day.
My number of the day is three. Three home runs in five innings for Fernando Tatis. Three grand slams in three games for the San Diego Padres. The first National League team and the first time since the Cleveland Spiders in 1895.
My number of the day, I'm veering away from baseball. You got the baseball number this time. I'm going with 23 points, 17 rebounds, and 16 assists. That was LeBron's stat line in the first game against the Portland Trailblazers, which they managed to lose. He is the first player in NBA history to post at least 20 points, at least 15 rebounds, and at least 15 assists in a postseason game. No one else has done it.
Do you know what time he did that?
No, you tell me what time. Oh.
He did that on Dame time.
There it is. I knew there was a setup there. There you go. You're welcome. You can have that.
So, Amit, it's time for our new segment, News from the NBA Bubble.
Bubble news. Yeah.
Bubble news. We're going to do something different this time because, Amit, the end of the regular season bubble. So we wanted to go beyond the numbers of the NBA bubble and bring you guys some closeout stats from the bubble. So most points in the bubble. Any guesses on it? Who that could be?
I think it's Dame time. I think it's
That's
your boy
right.
Dame.
It's Damian Lillard, Dame Dollar, one of the best Dames out there. He's right up there with Dame Judy Dench. I mean,
wow.
He's a top Dame. I'm
you know
just
what?
Putting it out there. Well,
I have no words. How many points did he score, Telly?
Putting it out there. 301 points. In second place was our runner-up for bubble MVP, Devin Booker, who balled out and scored 244 points. And then the human scoring machine that is James Harden, who scored 239 points, came in third. So those are the points leaders in the bubble. Most bubble assists. That goes to Ja Morant with 79 assists. A rookie leads that list. You know who number two on that list is, Amit, in assists?
You sound happy enough where it may be Dame.
That's right. Dame Dollar. He turns a dollar into 50 plus 50 cents. That's a dollar. So Dame is distributing the ball and helping guys score. And he only came in second on that list by two with 77 assists. And Luka Doncic comes in third with 68 assists. Most rebounds in the bubble goes to Jonas Valanciunas, who got 92 rebounds in the bubble. Congratulations to all the teams and all the guys who participated in the regular season of the bubble. And now we're into the playoffs. So in bubble news, actually, there was a Kevin Durant sighting. He was playing basketball, baby. So he couldn't play for the Nets, or he didn't want to play for the Nets, baby. But he could play against Drake for Nike in the music video. I'm just saying, he didn't want to show up. He didn't want to play this year, but he's playing one-on-one with Drake.
I think Drake probably provides a different level of competition than some of the men in the bubble. I could be wrong. I saw the video. Drake can ball. He's got some time.
So it's a little bit different. The video looked fun. Your boy OBJ was in there. There was a guest appearance by Beast Mode in there as well. It That's was right. a tight video, so we checked that out. You know what? Who was not in that video? Zion Williamson. There were no Zion sightings in the video, but his load management actually cost his coach his job.
Zion was under like early MJ rules where he could only play like 18 minutes in the whole game. Anyway, unfortunately, that led to the Pelicans firing Alvin Gentry. And in Gentry's five seasons, the Pelicans went 175-225, but they were often completely overrun with injuries. Gentry was forced to use, this was crazy, Telly, 140 different starting lineups in five seasons. According to Elias, that's the most any team in the past five seasons has done, and it's 11 more than the next closest team, the Dallas Mavericks.
And what's crazy is, you know, Alvin Gentry's he's a great coach. He wasn't given a great situation to succeed. AD wanted out, forced his way to the Lakers, sat down, refused to play. Zion comes in, next best thing. Zion immediately gets hurt. He's on load management. They stop using him. It's hard to win games without your best player. I feel like they set him up a little bit for the okie doke here. We are hopeful that he will land on his feet. I hope that the Golden State Warriors bring him back to be an assistant coach here. We can go ahead and get, you know what I'm going to say, Amit. You know who we're getting. You know who we're getting. And you know what we're going to do next year. So I
don't even want to hear. I don't even want to hear about your Giannis talk. We all know.
Giannis.
No,
Stephen
no.
Giannis.
You're not getting Giannis. Do you know why you're not getting Giannis?
That's the next Coach Shaq. That's the next Shaq and Penny. That's it right there.
First of all, as a ex Knicks fan, you know, just like the Knicks were going to bring LeBron 10 years ago, and they were going to bring KD last year, they're now going to get Giannis when he's up for free agency. You know that. That's going to happen.
Yep. And Kyle will fly. In the Jazz Nuggets series, Donovan Mitchell scored 57 points in their game one loss. Let me tell you something. That's the third highest scoring performance in NBA playoffs history. At 23 years old, he exploded for 57 points, which is the third highest mark behind only Elgin Baylor, who scored 61 points in 1962, and Michael Jeffrey Jordan, which we told you about in Beyond the Numbers episode 4, who went off for 63 points in 1986 against Larry Bird in the Boston Celtics, to which Larry Bird said, "That was God on the court shooting. He could not miss." That game also gave us another nugget of sorts. Jamal Murray of the Denver Nuggets, who's a baller, closed out the game for the Nuggets. He scored over 20 points in just the fourth quarter in overtime. And then the most bubble thing ever happened, Amit. He sang Donovan's praises in the interview after the game, saying, quote, "We just couldn't stop that guy tonight." Then he runs into him at the dining hall and posts it on IG, LOLing, like laughing, saying like, "Dude, we couldn't stop this guy. And I got to run into him here while I'm trying to get my food right now." So that was pretty hilarious and probably the most bubble thing ever, because when else would you run into your opponent freshly after the game? Like, they're in the same hotel.
It's like they're in the same dorm. Yeah.
The Mavericks-Clippers series was supposed to be easy for the Clippers. There's a guy by the name of Luka Doncic who goes on to score 42 points in his playoff debut. And he became the first player to ever score more than 40 points in his first postseason game.
After he dropped 42 in game one, he dropped 28 in game two, which brings him to a total of 70 points in his first two playoff games, passing Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who had 69, for the second most points ever scored by a player in their first two playoff games.
Luka scored 70 points in the first two games. He dropped 42 in game one, and they would have won, Amit, if not for poor Porzingis, your boy, your favorite Knicks player ever. I know.
I don't know why you got to keep bringing up the Knicks, but that ejection, you know, I get it from a rule standpoint, but it just seemed weird. He got the first one for the fist bump, and then I don't know why he decided to get in a pushing match. to get tossed. It seemed like a very Knicks move, but you're right, because at that point, the Mavs had pretty good control of that game.
And the Mavs were up at that point.
And with him out, all of a sudden it changed. So it's going to be a tough
season. Yeah, so it's a 1-1. It's a 1-1 series now, but had Porzingis not got ejected, this could be 2-0 Mavs over the Clippers, who are favored for the title.
Yeah.
And sticking with the Mavs, the NBA has been at the forefront of the ongoing social justice movement in the U.S. for months now. And the WNBA, shouts out to the WNBA. And its players aren't the only ones trying to raise awareness with their words and actions inside the Orlando bubble. Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle starts each press conference with reading from the Equal Justice Initiative calendar. Every day that calendar lists an anniversary of a moment relevant to racial injustice in America. Carlisle recounted this last one, how the incident sparked by white police officers baiting a young black man ultimately left 34 dead, 1,032 injured, 4,000 arrested, and over $40 million in damage. After a brief pause to allow the reporters to absorb this information, the Mavs head coach continues to talk about basketball. So it's just showcasing how he might be in privilege, he might be the coach, but he's also using his voice in the bubble to showcase the injustices going on in America. I'm sure that the players are playing lights out now because they can tell that their coach cares. Lakers Blazers, Amit. Do you know what time game one took place of this series?
Telly, I know you're going to throw Dame time at me again. And based on the outcome of that game and the way he played, it in fact was Dame time.
I mean, it started at 7 p.m. Pacific time, but
get out of here.
They did win game one. So the Blazers won game one. I guess you could say that was Dame time right there. And speaking of the Lakers, breaking news. This week it was revealed that LeBron saved your other favorite New York Knicks life, Carmelo Anthony. And I'm just going to tell y'all to Google that one. Just Google that.
2015.
And you'll learn more about that story.
2015. I don't even want to talk about it right now. Maybe next week. Maybe next week.
He almost wasn't a Knick after that, but thank goodness LeBron James saved his life.
Yes, thank goodness he saved Melo so that they could still not do anything year to year. But it was fun to watch him. I did enjoy it. Lastly, I want to point out how the game has changed in the past 40 years. 1980 is when the three-point line was introduced to the NBA. The 1980 Lakers, in 16 games, shot a combined 18 three-pointers. Fast forward to 2020. The Houston Rockets, in game two of their opening series against OKC, shot 55 three-point attempts in one game.
How the game has changed.
How
you know what
the
game
has changed. That the Knicks are still garbage.
And always will be about buckets.
That's the news from the bubble.
News from the NBA bubble.
Bubble news.
Yeah. Bubble news. For our first story, we want to give an update on college football cancellations. Where are we now? Numbers 130 and 146. The University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, known as UNC, had 130 positive COVID cases since school began. That's a positivity rate of 13.6. The state rate is only 6%. The University of Notre Dame had 146 positive COVID-19 cases. That's a positivity rate of 19.1, and the state rate is only 8.9. These statistics are as of this past Tuesday.
For those of you that don't know, in our last episode, BTN 21, we provided an update on college football cancellations. We talked about how the Big Ten and the Pac-12 decided to postpone, but the SEC, ACC, and Big 12 are still on as of this recording.
It's crazy that the SEC, ACC, Big 12 are still deciding to carry on. Like you said, no updates as of today when we're recording this. But one of the Big Ten members, Amit Rutgers, had at least 30 football players test positive for the coronavirus since the team returned to campus in mid-June. Head coach Greg Schiano, yes, you heard that right, Greg Schiano is back as the head coach of Rutgers, said that there were 30 to 31 total cases and that all the players are doing well. Only two remain quarantined. Half the group showed no symptoms, he said, and the worst case was like a very bad flu where the players sweat, quote, through the sheets. That's as bad as he believes that it can get. All the players who have tested positive are receiving full cardiac workups.
The worst that can happen, it's the flu, but we got to check your heart because there's concerns about myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart, and it's been found in some COVID-19 patients. Of course, we've been talking about this for a couple of weeks now, and we have the Red Sox ace Eduardo Rodriguez is out because of this, and his actual future is in question right now. They're not sure how he's going to recover, what that's going to look like, and if he's going to be able to play again. So there are definitely some potential long-term risks if you contract COVID-19.
So just imagine 30 players tested positive. Luckily, they caught those. It could spread among the team. Rutgers plays Ohio State. How many guys from Rutgers who are positive, give it to guys at Ohio State potentially, give it to guys at Michigan potentially, go home and visit their families, give it to their families, and that's what we're talking about with the spread not being able to be contained if there's a college football season. There are estimates that the lack of a football season will cost Rutgers $50 million. Head coach Greg Schiano will keep his 10% salary cut in place. Thanks so much, coach, for your 10% donation there. And Schiano did not want to talk about how the pandemic has affected the team, noting that many people have either, quote, died or suffered a family tragedy. So that's a really important part, right? Being a former college football player, like, mental health is important for these guys. These are college age students that you're talking about, but we don't want to talk about how their family members may have died or people they know may have died. We just want you to shut up and play, basically.
Despite everything going on at Rutgers, Ohio State's quarterback Justin Fields started a petition to get the Big Ten to play. And in his petitions, he wrote that the players believed that the safety protocols that were established by the school can be maintained and would mitigate concerns regarding exposure to COVID-19. And he also goes on to say that he believes that the players should be the ones that make the decisions about what's best for their health and future. But they also have to understand that your decisions, right, about your own health also is making decisions about other people's health around you, right, based on how you act, how what you do. Miami Marlins saw this firsthand. We've been over this over and over again. One guy made a decision about his own health. 18 guys had to deal with the consequences of that decision. We're going to see situations like this.
You're talking about college students. I mean, you have to protect guys from themselves, right? Like, players want to play. Like, of course you want to play. You can have a broken leg and want to play. Does that mean that's in the best interest of your future, especially when there's heart conditions and there's a spread that can go throughout the community, through your family, your parents, et cetera, et cetera? It's just interesting to me that the kids' decision, the players, the college students decide, we can handle this, we want to play. What was even more interesting, Amit,
is the parents. Even parents have joined in the protests as well. 6 weeks after the Ivy Leagues decided not to play fall sports and a week and a half after the Big Ten and Pac-12 made the same call, Ohio State football dad Randy Wade plans to lead a group of what he hopes will be dozens of other Big Ten football parents in protesting the conference's decision to postpone football to the winter or spring, presuming it's safe to play then. Wade, whose son Sean is a highly regarded cornerback for the Buckeyes, said that he's heard from about 70 to 100 people from the six of the 14 Big Ten schools, which are Ohio State, Penn State, Indiana, Purdue, Iowa, and Nebraska. Wade himself will be flying from Jacksonville, Florida to be part of this protest.
And that's crazy to me because, like we just talked about, right? students making the decision, players want to play, the kids making the decision is one thing, but the parents, you know, is totally different. And to me, this is really all about FOMO, fear of missing out. What parent wants their kid to sit out when other people's kids are still playing? And Wade and the other parents probably wouldn't be making so much noise about this if all the conferences just shut it down and postponed. What they don't want to do is watch the kids from the ACC, SEC, and Big 12 get all the shine while their kids can't, right? They move up in the rankings. They can move up in the draft. They have a chance to win a national championship, and your kid does not. So, again, it comes back to what we've been talking about, that this is just a money grab for certain schools and conferences, and that no one really has a vested interest in the health and safety of the players. And we talked about this with the NCAA in our last episode. And we also talked about how the players don't have a union or representation. So back to the number that I gave you at the top, 177. So 177 was enough positive tests to prompt the university to cancel all in-person classes due to safety and move to online learning. But UNC, who's in the ACC, will still have to play football this season. So campus is not safe enough to have students on it, but we can have the football players, minus the being a college student part, be on campus purely for football games. And again, it blurs the lines between what is a student athlete and what is just an athlete that's not getting paid, because the student part is removed if there's no other students, and the student part is removed if there's not in-person classes. So that's one side of the coin, and we wanted to bring it to you, but not everyone is jumping at the bit to get college football immediately going, as there have actually been some opt-outs as well.
You're right. Not everyone is on board to get this thing kicked off, and specifically, we've seen some opt-outs from various colleges nationwide. Now, the big one that came, that we both, I think, found similarly around the same time, was Georgia State's freshman quarterback, Michael Colasarudo, opted out of the 2020 season due to a heart condition that developed after he contracted COVID-19 during the offseason. The 6'1", 210-pounder from Chapman High School in Inman, South Carolina, announced his decision in a post on Twitter. And in the statement, he said, "I'm very thankful for everyone who's reached out and prayed for me. I'm also incredibly thankful for the coach, Sean Elliott, and trainer, Bob Murphy, for providing a safe environment for us to train and practice. Ultimately, it was the procedures and tests set forth by GSU that allowed the doctors to find this condition in my heart and keep me safe. I'm very thankful."
A condition he wouldn't have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's thankful that they found a condition that he had because he contracted COVID-19, right? And I know we've talked about this before. Myocarditis, which is what he has, is an inflammation of the heart muscle that has been linked to viral infections, including COVID-19. And it's become one of the factors concerning numerous athletes in all levels of sports, numerous pro athletes, and of course, commissioners and various college presidents are weighing this as they decide to play this fall or spring.
Which, again, knowing that this virus, it's not the flu, it's not a cold, it can cause life-lasting damage to the heart muscle, the heart in a human being. Knowing that information, conferences are still deciding to go forward and play. And his issue wouldn't have been caught unless he went through a full physical with the team. So Georgia State, which is part of the Sun Belt, is slated to kick off a 10-game 2020 season at home Saturday, September 19th against Louisiana. And it can actually add two more conference games by the guidelines that the Sun Belt set forth, which is crazy to me. And I want to localize this conversation and information and story a little bit more for you guys. So those that listen to the podcast are familiar by now, but those that don't know, I played my college ball for the Florida Gators, and I'll be the first to admit to being biased for the Gators on here, and you'll hear me say it time and time again, and I have a lot of fun with it. I'm a Gator boy through and through. I bleed orange and blue. I will note, no UF players have tested positive for COVID-19 since mandatory workouts began July 14th, and no players have been quarantined due to contact with infected individuals. So the Florida Gators are managing this as best as they can at the moment, and I've seen a couple videos, I've gotten a couple emails about it. But news broke this week that receivers Trayvon Grimes, Kadarius Toney, Jacob Copeland, and DN Zachary Carter all sat out of Monday's practice, and it's unclear if they're the only players who opted out Monday. Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland tweeted their thoughts on opting out of the 2020 season, and if Grimes, Toney, and Copeland end up opting out, those were our top three receivers last year, Rick Wells would be the leading receiver with only two catches for 27 yards. Now, we definitely understand the concerns, right? Grimes is probably concerned of the impacts of the virus because his mom battled cancer, and that's what led to him transferring to Florida to be closer to family and help care for his mom when he transferred from Ohio State. Carter also cited that some family members have had issues with COVID-19, and that caused him to think long and hard about playing. And that is the reason we have to be considered of bringing people back and having a season. Coach Mullen said, quote, he really wouldn't be surprised if we had coaches opt out because coaches are at such high risk because of the age group that they're in. So the final question we have, and these were just updates we wanted to give you guys and lay in a little bit of our thoughts, but is this the college football season that we want? Do we want the top three receivers from a top team in the nation to sit out? Do we want half the coaches not being able to coach? You know, Amit, do we want guys to develop heart conditions so we can watch a couple of games that these young men will have to live with this for the rest of their lives? And that's really what it comes down to. Like, are we really willing to sacrifice the game so it won't be top quality games, right? The NBA has pulled it off. LeBron's still there. There's not a ton of opt-outs. You still have a high level of competition, which goes back to what you said, bubble versus non-bubble. But are we willing to sacrifice the level of games that we're going to watch if a bunch of players sit and a bunch of coaches sit? And the second question is, what do you do if somebody dies? Like, what is the liability on it? If a student catches this and, heaven forbid, the worst happens, who's liable for that?
I mean, the conversation at that point will be, as we've heard from the reasons of why to play, they were just as likely to get it caught at home. And with the NCAA specifically saying they didn't want colleges to have any opt-out clauses or anything like that for liability, I'm sure at some point it's going to come down to those colleges. But there's still some time. I'm still intrigued to see how this fully plays out and what those games are going to look like. One way or another, college football is not going to look the way we're used to seeing it.
I'm still not sure we have a college football season this year, Amit. I'll be honest, Beyonders. I'm still not sure we have a season this season. I'm hopeful. I'm excited. But I'm still not sure we'll have a season this year.
No, I feel you. I had the same thing with baseball. And even with the season started, I don't think, you know, in my head, oh, we're not going to make it past 35 games. We'll see. I don't know what it's going to look like. But, you know, at the end of the day, you hope that it works out the best for the guys that are playing. And of course, you know, if you can safely have college football, it'd be a lot of fun for all of us. For our second story today, in honor of the 100th anniversary of the Negro Leagues, we wanted to give a brief history of the Negro Leagues. The number for this segment, 35. 35 Negro League players are currently in the MLB Baseball Hall of Fame. And that's 35 out of 333 total elected members, which includes 235 former Major League players, 31 executives, the 35 Negro Leaguers, 22 managers, and 10 umpires.
For those that don't know, the United States of America were once segregated, and so was baseball. So there was a Negro League, as they were not allowed to join the major leagues at that time. We talked about this a bit in BTN episode 17 when we talked about HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities. This was the alternative in place.
So when did this all start? So African Americans began to play baseball in the late 1800s on military teams, college teams, and company teams. They eventually found their way to professional teams with white players, so integrated teams. Moses Fleetwood Walker and Bud Fowler were amongst the first to participate. Now, Negro League Baseball got its start thanks to the increasing popularity of two things after the Civil War, Telly. Two things: baseball and segregation.
That's a great thing. Not a good thing. Bad thing. Very much bad thing.
The National Association of Amateur Baseball Players rejected African American membership in 1867. And in 1876, owners of the Professional National League adopted a gentleman's agreement to keep black players out.
Sounds always similar to Colin Kaepernick, this gentleman's agreement.
I like that. That's a good little tie-in, Telly. Regardless, African Americans continued to play and even thrived at various levels of professional baseball. And then in 1884, catcher Moses Fleetwood Walker of the Toledo Blue Stockings became the first African American to play in what was then considered the major leagues. However, Walker and his fellow African Americans often faced, as you would assume, outright hostility and physical intimidation from both teammates and opponents. So you're fighting against the guys on the team and the guys on the other side. What really started to bring this segregation in was one specific case where in the 19th century, where superstar at that time, Cap Anson of the Chicago White Stockings, threatened to cancel a game with Toledo if Walker was in the lineup. And many people go back to this instance as really the main reason why this integrated baseball turned into a segregated system. Several of the top black players of the era, including fielders Frank Grant and Bud Fowler, and pitcher George Stovey, relocated to prominent international league play in New York, New Jersey, southeastern Canada. However, racial tensions persisted, and in 1887, African Americans were barred from signing new contracts in those venues as well. By the 1890s, black players were increasingly facing exclusion from organized baseball and finding more opportunities within traveling teams. The Cuban Giants, formed in 1885, Telly, you're gonna love this. They were formed in 1885 under the pretense of being dark-skinned Latin Americans. And they traversed...
Dominicans, basically.
They traversed...
They're trying to be like me. They're just trying to be like me and my people. I got you.
So these guys traversed the East in a private railroad car to play local squads wherever they could find them. Fowler's Page Fence Giants enjoyed an impressive success against both black and white opponents. And in 1895, they ended up winning 118 of 154 games they played. The close of the century brought to an end the formal integration of baseball. And in 1899, Bill Galloway appeared in 5 games for Woodstock, Ontario of the Canadian League. He was the last official person of color to play in the league before it was completely segregated. Save for attempts to pass African Americans off as Spanish or Native Americans, there would be no more blacks in white professional leagues for more than 4 decades, Telly.
Yeah, it's crazy to think. And, you know, as we go through the history and the current climate, we're going through a lot of history of the country, history of a lot of educational systems, history of professional sports. Really interesting, really fascinating, and it was fun to do research for this piece.
This was news to me too, because, you know, we focused so much on Jackie Robinson in the 1940s that you don't realize that, wait, there was a time before where it was also integrated to a certain extent. And just to see all this history was really, really, really fun, and it was cool.
A lot of history that's left out is Reconstruction, the period after the Civil War. where a lot of African Americans were freed and participated in elections. They were elected officials. There were some in Congress in the 1800s, Ahmed. As hard as it is to believe, there were people serving, and then there was an uprising and all that was removed. But also to see that happen in baseball as well was fascinating. So how did this all start? How did we get here? So in the 1920s, an organized league structure was formed under the guidance of Andrew Rube Foster, a former player, manager, and owner for the Chicago American Giants. In a meeting held in Kansas City, Missouri, Foster and a few other Midwestern team owners joined to form the NNL, or the Negro National League. In the same year the NNL was created, the Negro Southern League was formed by Thomas T. Wilson by bringing together all the black teams located below the Mason-Dixon line. Teams from Nashville, Atlanta, Birmingham, Memphis, Montgomery, and New Orleans united to play the game in a, quote, safe environment. Remember, this is within the segregated, very heavily segregated South at that time. In 1923, the Eastern Colored League started in the North, consisting of the, and I love these names, so I just wanted to say them because I really like the team names, the Hilldale Club, the Cuban Stars from the East, Brooklyn Royal Giants, the Baccarat Giants, the Lincoln Giants, and the Baltimore Black Sox. That was a safe name. I think they all liked being Giants. The leagues maintained a high level of professional skill and became centerpieces for economic development in many black communities. By 1930, the old Negro League was falling apart due to the Great Depression, which hit the whole country, but most especially communities of color, and Foster's absence as the leader of the league. He was unable to be the commissioner due to an array of mental issues. The 1930s did provide fresh opportunities for a new league when Gus Greenlee came onto the scene. William Augustus Gus Greenlee, I just had to say that correctly there, saw that baseball could be a great venue for gambling. So he decided to create a new Negro National League in 1933. But essentially, this became him serving as the new commissioner of the existing league. While serving as the de facto commissioner of the league, he also owned the Pittsburgh Crawfords. The Crawfords were the best team in the league, featuring Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell, Judy Johnson, and Oscar Charleston. And you know, Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson are very notable players that even translated outside of the Negro Leagues. The prospect of making big money in the Negro Leagues never existed for players. So it's not like today when you're a pro athlete and you get big contracts and makes lots of money. In many cases, players took the money they earned and went to graduate schools at various HBCUs around the country, hoping to have a different career after playing. HBCUs became a de facto farm system for the Negro Leagues, with players squaring off against college teams in the offseason to prepare for games.
So when did all of this end? Well, in 1945, Major League Baseball's Brooklyn Dodgers recruited Jackie Robinson from the Kansas City Monarchs, and Robinson now became the first African American in the modern era to play on a Major League roster. And while this historic event was a key moment in baseball and in civil rights history, it prompted the decline of the Negro Leagues. Now that the best black players were being recruited for the major leagues, the black fans also followed them. It makes sense. And unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, the last Negro Leagues teams folded in the early 1960s. I think a lot of the history behind the Negro Leagues and what was there and why it was there is often forgotten or not really shared. And for me, going through and doing the research for this, and we've just really touched the surface on this, wanting to give all of you an overview into some things you didn't know, but there's just so much history and knowledge and some great stories and things associated with the leagues.
So all was not lost, and there was actually some great crossover here. Five innovations were adopted, at least five innovations were adopted from the Negro League, some that you may not even think of were adopted by Major League Baseball. And this was actually research that I pulled from the Major League Baseball website itself. One, night baseball. So 5 years before any Major League club played under the lights, the Negro Leagues were already tapping into the practicality of night baseball. After the Great Depression devastated baseball clubs across America and Negro leagues in particular, like we shared, Kansas City Monarchs owner J.L. Wilkerson pushed all his chips to the center of the table. He mortgaged everything that he owned in 1929. Not a great year to do that, but he mortgaged everything he owned in 1929 to commission an Omaha company to build him a set of portable generator light towers. The Monarchs staged their first night game on April 28, 1930. And soon those 50-foot towers allowed Wilkerson's barnstorming club to play day, night doubleheaders, both in their home city and on the road. The second innovation was player movement. Major League Baseball's infamous reserve clause tethered players to their original clubs all the way through the 1970s. But the Negro League's looser contract structures created an environment for unprecedented player movement for the times. So basically the precursor for free agency, the Negro Leagues allowed players to play for the highest bidder, almost game to game, and almost between different seasons, so the guys could make as much money as possible and play it in front of as many fans as possible, something Satchel Paige would do, play in front of as many people as he could. Third was aggressive base running. They implemented bunting and being more aggressive on the base running pads. Four, batting helmets. Many historians cite Negro League star Willie Wells as the first professional player, black or white, to wear protective headgear at the plate. Opposing pitchers often threw at Newark Eagles star, and when Baltimore spitballer Bill Byrd knocked Wells unconscious with a pitch to the temple in 1936, Wells, disregarding a doctor's advice to sit out, actually played in Newark's very next game, wearing a modified construction hard hat at the plate. Neither the helmet nor the concussion limited Wells' at-bat. He was a consistent 300 hitter for the rest of the decade, not year, decade, and batting helmets weren't seen in the major leagues in any form until Brooklyn Dodgers general manager Larry McPhail made his entire club use hats with protective plate inserts in 1941. And lastly, number five, shin guards for catchers. Hall of Fame catcher Roger Breshannon is often credited with popularizing shin guards beginning in 1907. But he was not the first to don them in an organized game. In fact, catcher John Bud Fowler, who we mentioned at the top, pioneered shin guards for a much different reason than backstops wear them today. Also, fun fact, the MLB uniforms took the concept of including numbers on the uniforms from the Negro Leagues.
It's cool to see the touch that Major League that the Negro Leagues have had on Major League Baseball.
I think this shows diverse schools of thought, and whether it's in the boardroom, whether it's in sports, whether, you know, it's in your personal life among friends, it's great to have a collect diverse group of thoughts from different backgrounds and different experiences, because it brings the best ideas to the forefront. And this goes to show that, you know, this league had a lot to offer, and they didn't ever see it as they weren't included in something. They saw it as an opportunity to further their betterment and further their league, and they were proud to be a part of that league. And I think that's really important.
All of those things that, you know, the Negro Leagues brought to Major League Baseball in terms of innovation, there's one thing that's still missing. According to Major League Baseball's current records and classifications, the players whom this year's Major Leaguers honored this past Sunday were not Major Leaguers themselves. Because of a prejudiced decision on a committee that met more than 50 years ago, the Negro Leagues are still excluded from the official list of major leagues, much as black players before 1947, and in many cases long after, were excluded from the American and National Leagues. Like those players, the Negro Leagues have been denied an opportunity to prove that they were as deserving of major league status as their white contemporaries. But for the first time, MLB is considering righting this wrong, and they've started to have the conversations about what it would take and what they would need to do to incorporate the Negro Leagues as a major league, thus making sure that all of those stats that happened in that league would translate into the history books as being major league stats. So in a lot of ways, that would certify that these guys were real players, they knew what they were doing, and they played at a level that we all know they did, but it has not been recognized yet. I'm pushing for it. I'm excited to see that they've started to take the first steps.
And there's been a petition on it to rename the Baseball MVP Award the Josh Gibson Memorial Baseball Award. Let's wrap this thing up. So we went beyond the numbers of the NBA bubble and brought you the leaders in points, rebounds, and assists. For our first story, we followed up on the fluid status of college football. The ACC, SEC, and Big 12 are still going with business as usual for the most part. And we've got some parents involved in protesting and trying to bring the Big 10 to reverse their decision on postponing the season.
For our second story, we provided a short history lesson on the Negro Leagues, who are currently celebrating their 100-year anniversary. There is a rich history to be shared, and the impact of the Negro Leagues can be seen in how Major League Baseball operates today.
Thank you for going beyond the numbers with us. We're a weekly podcast dedicated to going beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. We're available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Whatever you're listening on now, please be sure to click the follow or subscribe button to get our latest content.
And remember, you can find us on Instagram, Beyond the Numbers Podcast, and on Twitter, at Beyond TN Podcast.
Until next time, peace!